Welcome to Interfaith Voices. We're the leading religion news magazine on public radio, a show about the way religion and spirituality inform our world. We're independent and listener-supported, and we come to you from the studios of WAMU 88.5, our partnering station in Washington, D.C. And this week, we welcome our brand new associate producer, Catherine Roberts. She comes to us from the University of Tulsa, where she graduated magna cum laude with degrees in economics and English. Catherine, we're so glad to have you as part of our team. And I'm your host, Maureen Fiedler. About one-third of Americans believe in intelligent design, according to a recent Gallup poll. That's the idea that humans evolved over time from lesser life forms, with the process guided by God. It's added a new dimension to the old debate about where humans come from, and raised serious concern in the scientific world about blending faith and science. Here to wade into the controversy with us are two guests. Stephen Meyer is the author of a new book called Darwin's Doubt: The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. He's the director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle, the leading group behind intelligent design. Michael Ruse is the director of the History and Philosophy of Science program at Florida State University in Tallahassee. Welcome to both of you to Interfaith Voices.
It's great to be with you, Maureen.
Thank you.
Now, first, Stephen, let's spell out the three most common approaches to the origin of human life. There's creationism, there's evolution, and there's intelligent design. Could you just briefly define each one? Start with creationism.
You bet. Creationism is the idea that life is the product of the fiat creation of God as interpreted by those who read the book of Genesis in a very particular way, in particular to say that the earth is very young, very recent, and the days of creation are literal 24-hour periods. What you called evolution, I would want to redefine as neo-Darwinian evolution. That's the standard textbook theory of evolution, and it affirms that life is the product of a slow, gradual, natural process, in particular the process of natural selection acting on random mutations, and that process, being undirected and unguided, produces the appearance of design in living organisms without those organisms being actually designed. Instead, neo-Darwinism would affirm that that appearance of design is an illusion. In between, there are a lot of interesting positions, and the one that I advocate is called intelligent design, and it holds that life is the product of a designing intelligence, and that there are certain features of life that are best explained by the activity of a designing intelligence rather than an unguided, undirected process such as natural selection and random mutation.
And Michael, is there anything in that basic description or set of definitions that you disagree with?
Well, I think that Steve would probably agree with me that creationism and intelligent design probably overlap, at least in some people's minds, more than he suggested. I mean, I do see more overlap there, whereas I don't think you could be an intelligent designer and a Darwinian evolutionist at the same time.
Yeah, not a Darwinian evolutionist, but you could accept other forms of evolution.
Oh, yes. I mean, yeah. Right back from Darwin, you know, his American colleague Asa Gray believed in some kind of guided evolution. I don't think he would be a full-blown intelligent designer, but he certainly believed that the mutations weren't random, as Darwin did.
I think this is actually a great place to start the discussion, Maureen, because I think both Michael and I have become frustrated, and I think many Americans are frustrated with the way in which this debate has been polarized between the fundamentalist creationist on the one hand and the new atheists who have embraced neo-Darwinism as a scientific basis for their atheism on the other. And there are a lot of interesting positions in the middle. And one of the things that my new book does is it tells the story of a doubt that Darwin had that's grown up to generate a very profound scientific problem about the origin of fundamentally new forms of animal life and how there are many new evolutionary positions that are being formulated that are breaking with neo-Darwinism. And it's into that mix that I propose the theory of intelligent design as having something to offer.
I want to come to that in just a minute, but I want to get a couple of other things clear first. Stephen, you talk about intelligent design and presumably an intelligent designer. Is that God? And if so, is it the Christian God?
Not necessarily. The theory of intelligent design, and one of the ways it's different from creationism, is very important. It's not based on scriptural texts or an interpretation of scripture. It's based on the scientific evidence from biology and physics. And what we can tell from the scientific evidence is that a mind of some kind is required to explain certain classes of phenomena, such as the digital information that's stored in DNA or the intricate molecular machinery that we find in cells or the fine-tuning of the laws and constants of physics. And so by applying some standard methods of scientific reasoning, in fact, the very ones that Darwin used, when we try to explain an event in the past, Darwin said that you should look for causes that are known to produce the effects in question. And what we know from experience is that when we find information-rich systems, for example, systems full of digital code, and we trace them back to their source, whether we're looking at a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book or information embedded in a radio signal, we always find that those information-rich structures have an intelligent source. And so by using Darwin's principle of reasoning, we can discern that there was a mind of some kind. We can't tell from the evidence the full identity of the mind, but that becomes in a sense, a second-order question that is ripe for philosophical deliberation, and people have different views on that.
And Michael, what would you add to that?
Well, I think, Steve, you're being just a little bit coy here. I won't use the word disingenuous, but it does come to mind. Do you honestly believe that this intelligent designer is natural? I mean, you talk about hieroglyphics or that sort of thing, which we presumably you do think are produced naturally. I mean, do you really think that we are here on Earth, the lab experiment of a grad student on Andromeda, running it to see how it all works?
To answer your question, I definitely don't think that. But what we can tell is that a mind, from the science, from the biology, what we can tell is that a mind of some kind was required. I think when you look at the evidence from physics as well, that suggests that we have design built into the fabric of the universe itself. And I think if you conjoin the evidence from biology with the evidence from physics, I think you are looking at a strong case for a designing mind that is transcendent, beyond the natural realm. So,
and let's get into the specific problem that you pose in your book, in Darwin's Doubt. And you say this is a problem that troubled even Darwin himself, and it's the so-called Cambrian explosion. Now, what is that?
Sure. The Cambrian explosion is the geologically sudden or abrupt appearance of most of the major animal forms. There are about 36 total phyla, which are the largest groups of animals in the classification scheme. 27 of them have been fossilized in the history of life. And of those 27, 23 appear in the Cambrian, and 20 of those 23 first appear in the Cambrian. So what you have is a pattern of pervasive appearance of animal life in the fossil record.
It's a sudden explosion of animal life?
Sudden, geologically speaking. It's probably the best date for the biggest pulse of the explosion is about a 10-million-year window.
About 10 million years ago?
No. It occurred about 530 million years ago, and the major pulse of the what's called the radiation or the diversification of animal life occurred within about a 10-million-year window. There's a 5-million-year window in which about 14 to 16 of the major phyla arise. And this, by reference to the Darwinian mechanism, is also very sudden biologically, because the Darwinian mechanism of mutation and natural selection must work very, very slowly. So it's both the biologically and geologically sudden appearance of animal life.
Okay. And of course, from your perspective, that is an explosion that is not adequately explained by the prior fossil record or by what came before it if one were applying natural evolution and natural selection.
Right. For two reasons. One, because you have a pervasive absence of Precambrian fossils. And Secondly, because what we've learned about the complexity of animal life, you've got code, you've got circuitry, you've got hierarchically organized information, each of which are phenomena that in our experience are always the product of intelligence. And so what I see in the Cambrian are telltale indicators of the role of intelligence or a purpose of design in the history of life.
Michael, does this Cambrian explosion, the rapid appearance of animal life on Earth, pose the same problem for you?
Well, no, and I think we have to go back to where Steve came in, where he said this was a big worry for Darwin. And he's absolutely right. Darwin in The Origin, the first edition of The Origin, is very worried about the Cambrian explosion. But what Steve doesn't mention is that the main reason why Darwin was so worried was he had absolutely no evidence of anything before that. But now, of course, and Steve knows full well, we have a fossil record going back over 3.5 billion years. And more than that, the kind of fossil record you would expect if you're dealing with natural origins. And as Steve well knows, although he plays it down in the book, before you get the Cambrian explosion, you're getting more and more sophisticated, more and more complex organisms. So, in fact, to say it's Darwin's doubt, it may be true in 1859, but I think it's a bad mistake simply to say, well, here we are, folks, with the same problem in 2013, because we're not with the same problem at all.
It sounds to me, Stephen, like there might have been new scientific evidence that has come into the world since the days when Darwin wrote The Origin of Species.
Well, absolutely. There are things that have been found in the Precambrian fossil record. And unfortunately, these go extinct right at the base of the Cambrian about 12 million years before the explosion. And most paleontologists don't think that these organisms have any strong affinities to the organisms that come later. In fact, many doubt that they're even animals. And as I point out in the book, the mystery is not just the absence of discernible ancestral fossils in the Precambrian. It's also this engineering mystery. We now know that information, digital information in DNA and other forms of information called epigenetic information are absolutely necessary to building complex animal forms. And the Darwinian mechanism of mutation and natural selection seems to many evolutionary biologists to lack the creative power to get that job done. And for that reason, there are 6 or 7 new evolutionary models that are being proposed to try to address this fundamental problem.
And Michael, how would you answer that?
Well, and frankly, I think that Steve, like everybody on his side, including the creationists, is into highly selective quotations. I mean, other reviewers, scientific reviewers of your book, have said exactly the same thing, that what you're doing is pulling out passages out of context, which make it sound as though we're in much bigger problems than we are.
And I've read some reviews of Darwin's Doubt. And some critics, like Gareth Cook, for example, in The New Yorker, said that the Cambrian explosion was not, in fact, an explosion. That was something that Darwin may have seen, but it's actually an event that took place over tens of millions of years.
Yeah,
and so could this have been misread?
Thanks for raising that. In the book and also on our blog, evolutionnews.org, we've rebutted that claim extensively. But most Cambrian paleontologists accept a date for the main pulse of new morphological innovation, that is the origin of new, fundamentally new forms of life in body plants. It's about a 10-million-year window. But I do acknowledge that there's a definitional aspect to that, but I use the standard date.
And Michael, how do you deal with that?
I find the scientists, people like Prothero, who seems to be Steve's doppelganger as far as I can make out, says, you know, you've got to take the Cambrian as being, or the explosion, or so-called, as a much longer period of time. And once you start to do that, then it's nothing like as explosive. It's not necessary to bring in new sorts of mechanisms or these sorts of things. The fact of the matter is, and Steve knows this, that we just know so much more than Darwin did.
We're speaking about intelligent design with two philosophers of science. Stephen Meyer is the author of the new book, Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. And Michael Ruse is a professor at Florida State University who specializes in the relationship between science and religion. We'll take a short break here and be right back.
Interfaith Voices is supported in part by the Institute of Pastoral Studies at Loyola University Chicago, offering graduate degrees in ministry, spirituality, and more. Courses are taught in Chicago, Rome, and online, on the web at luc.edu/IPS. The Institute of Pastoral Studies, education for ministry in the 21st century.
I'm Maureen Fiedler, and this is Interfaith Voices. According to a 2012 Gallup poll, roughly one-third of Americans say they believe in intelligent design. The idea that humans evolved over time through a process guided by God. It's an idea that has raised alarm bells among many in the science world, who say the concept is untestable, without evidence, and goes beyond the scope of science. Here to talk about arguments for and against the theory are two philosophers of science. Stephen Meyer is the author of the new book, Darwin's Doubt: The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. And Michael Ruse is director of the History and Philosophy of Science program at Florida State University in Tallahassee. He specializes in the relationship between science and religion. Let's rejoin my conversation now. Many people have suggested that intelligent design is pseudoscience, as I'm sure you know, Stephen. So what criteria does a theory need for it to be science? And does intelligent design make the cut?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think that is really the underlying issue that separates even Michael and me, who are operating in this broad middle ground.
I'm not that much of a middleman, Steve. I don't like the new atheists, but I'm on their side rather than yours.
When it comes to evolution,
we can be bigger opponents than we have sometimes been. I don't care either way. It's fine.
Okay.
Yeah. In any case, the issue of the definition of science, the definition that is being asserted is that to be a scientist, you must limit yourself to strictly materialistic explanations of all phenomena. The problem with that is that there are certain kinds of phenomena, in particular, the origin of information, digital, typographic, or alphabetic information that we know from experience are not well explained by reference to materialistic causes. If you walk into the British Museum and look at the Rosetta Stone, and you see all those wonderful inscriptions of the three different languages, no archaeologist would say, "Whoa, that's wonderful! What wind and erosion did." You, as an archaeologist, do not want to be limited to strictly materialistic causes to explain certain types of phenomena, because we know that information-rich systems invariably arise from intelligent source. So I see decisive evidence of a teleological or purposive intelligence in the origin of those animal forms. And I come to that conclusion by applying Darwin's principle of reasoning that we should be looking for causes that are known to have the capacity to produce the effect in question, the effect we're trying to explain.
And so let me try to put this in simple English if I can. What you're saying is that when you look at the evidence, you're looking for something that will explain it adequately, and it seems because of the information that's there, which had not been apparent before, it would require an intelligence to have produced that information.
Exactly. I used to ask my students, Maureen, a question. If you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? And they would right away, you know, it's code or instructions. The same thing is true in life. If you want to build a new form of animal life, the evolutionary process would have to provide new information.
Okay.
But what we know from experience is that information always comes from a mind. So the limitation on science that says you can't invoke a non-materialistic explanation is contrary to what we know from our uniform and repeated experience.
Okay, and Michael, would you agree with that? Do you think of it? Sounds like you probably wouldn't.
Maureen, why don't you just simply say, why do you disagree with that?
All right. I assume you think intelligent design is pseudoscience then. Am I right?
Well, I don't think it's pseudoscience. I think it's religion, quite frankly. But let's just backtrack a sec. Steve's been using the word materialistic. I don't know about materialistic. I much prefer to use the word naturalistic. And, of course, Steve himself would use that many occasions. Now, the thing about science is there's no a priori necessity for being natural and not introducing supernatural causes. Newton, as we well know, did. However, what scientists have found through the years since the scientific revolution, we find that we don't need to make those sorts of assumptions. And I'm saying that when we come to evolutionary biology, we're still at that point. The problem with what Steve does, he picks out this one issue of the Cambrian explosion and says, let's talk about that. But of course, no evolutionary biologist is starting with the Cambrian explosion. They're starting with the overall picture, where we know lots of cases where things look quite remarkable. I mean, how did anything start to fly? How did whales come? But of course, thanks to the fossil record and other things like that, we now know a great deal more about that. And so we're coming in with that background. Then we come to a puzzle like the Cambrian explosion. We don't say, oh, gosh, this is tremendously difficult. Let's bring in miracles. Let's bring in God. And that, of course, is what Steve is doing. So the point is, scientists say, we don't need that hypothesis, at least not for a long while. And we're slowly starting to piece together this story. Don't give up now, and certainly don't bring in God. That's not doing science. That's not even pseudoscience. That's religion.
What are the criteria for something to be a scientific theory?
Well, I would say today that it's going to be something which is going to be explained naturalistically. That's to say, we're going to appeal to unbroken laws which just go on, as it were, indefinitely, that we don't need supernatural causes to explain things. We're going to have certain methodologies. I mean, Karl Popper, for instance, said that all science must be put up for check to be falsified. Obviously, a major part of a good new theory is it's going to be predictable, predictably fertile. And of course, this, of course, has been one of the big criticisms against intelligent design theory, even if it were science, that it doesn't seem to lead to the kind of predictability or predictive fertility that one's looking for. But as I say, the main thing is science is going to rule out interventions by the Almighty. Not because scientists are atheists, some are, probably most are, at least in America, but simply because it's just not pragmatically a very useful thing to do. In fact, not only is it not pragmatically a very useful thing to do, it's a really stupid thing to do, because once you start bringing in God and saying, oops, I've got a problem, invoke God, what is known as the God of the gaps sort of a position, then you stop doing science. And the whole point about science is really good science gets going when you've got something you can't explain and you're a bright young grad student or you're after a Nobel Prize and you just keep at it until you crack the problem.
And I'm wondering why intelligent design has become quite popular in more recent years. Because about 25 years ago, there was a Supreme Court case, Edwards versus Aguilar, which prohibited essentially teaching creation science in school. Now, this would have been the Genesis version of the creation story, because it was considered religion. And to some people, intelligent design looks like a way to circumvent the court rulings. What do you think, Stephen? Is intelligent design a way to bring God into a scientific classroom kind of by another route?
No, definitely not. There's an urban myth kind of history circulating, but I was in the 80s when a lot of the ideas about intelligent design were being formulated, and they were being formulated by people who were definitely against the attempt to put creationism into the classrooms that Edwards v. Aguilar struck down. So that's, I think, the reason that there's so much new interest in intelligent design, and this was certainly what captured my interest, was precisely this problem of the origin of information. It takes an intelligent agent to generate information. And the reason the hypothesis has become so attractive to many scientists is that we precisely do need that as a causal explanation for certain types of phenomena. And in fact, we see those phenomena, those information-rich structures in living organisms. You can't build Cambrian animals without that information.
And Michael, he's articulating something that a lot of advocates of intelligent design say, namely that evolutionists are often unwilling to entertain the possibility of an intelligent designer, the possibility of God, if you will. So what do you say to that contention?
Well, it's not a question of entertaining the possibility of God. Scientists are doing science. They're not doing religion. So they don't have to bring it in. It has been entertained in the past. No need to entertain it now. Get on with doing the science. I mean, Steve, again, is being disingenuous because he knows full well that in 2005 in Dover, Pennsylvania, the judge ruled once again that intelligence design is evangelical Christianity dressed up to look like science to get around the First Amendment separation of church and state.
Michael, you and I are philosophers of science, and we don't look to federal judges to define science. That's a question way above their grade. So I think you're hurting my feelings with that disingenuous charge. I mean, you and I are, I think as professionals in this field, we know that we don't look to judges to settle those issues, and we were opposed to what the Dover School Board was doing. The question is, what does the evidence say, what do federal judges say about the definition of science?
But federal judges do make rulings about what you can teach in public schools and what you can't.
And we're not pushing to get intelligent design into the public schools. So that's really not the issue. The issue is whether or not the...
Who's the we here? Steve, you know...
Michael,
no, absolutely. No, you have to let me speak for my own institute and what our position has been. We opposed the Dover trial. I was asked to testify in it. I declined. And I've been writing books about intelligent design, not doing advocacy to get it into the public schools.
Michael, this is a question directed at you. Some people would say that intelligent design is not only not science, it might be dangerous because it muddies the water between what religion and science are.
I'm not sure that I worry about that so much. I do worry, I think, that there's not just a religious, but I think there's also a social agenda which is being pushed by evangelicals who are pushing intelligent design. And that's certainly so if you look at their writings, that they're certainly pushing an overall, as I say, conservative agenda with which I don't agree. So I don't look upon this debate about intelligent design theory as just epistemological or just philosophical or just scientific. I see it as in a broader sense as being cultural and social, and that's a major reason why I oppose it. I mean, I don't find it tremendously intellectually exciting to talk about intelligent design theory, but I do because I think it's a morally important thing to do. It sounds a bit preachy, but there you are.
Stephen?
I think you have to assess the truth of a theory by reference to the evidence marshaled in support of it. And people can take ideas. They've certainly taken Darwinism in lots of different directions. One of the negative reviews of my book was in a right-wing magazine, the National Review. And so I don't think this is associated or needs to be associated with any conservative or political agenda. This is simply, it's an ancient question. It goes all the way back to the Greeks. Is matter eternal, self-existent, self-creating, and self-organizing? That was one school of thought in Greek philosophy. The other is that a mind is needed to either shape or create matter in the first place. And intelligent design is in that latter tradition, affirming the mind over matter view of reality rather than the idea that matter has the inherent capacity to organize itself.
Michael, you maintain in your writings that science and religion don't have to be at war, as they have been for a long time over questions posed by evolution. But how do you get past that conflict then?
Well, as I say, I think that there are certain basic claims in religion which are simply not touched by science. But at the same time, I want to say that these claims are very carefully circumscribed. I mean, I don't think that you can claim there was a universal flood. I think science shows that that's just not on. And I personally don't think that you can argue that God got to work busily at the time of the Cambrian explosion. So the fact that I'm prepared to allow, for instance, that there was a creator... and things of this nature, that we are special in God's eyes. I'm prepared to allow all of that, but it doesn't follow that I'm going to allow every last claim which is in the Old Testament.
And so, therefore, the sphere of religion is very different from the sphere of science, but it's certainly possible for someone to be a believer and to also adhere to the theory of evolution.
Oh, I think so. Darwin thought so.
And Stephen, how about you? How would you get past the age-old conflict between science
and
religion?
Well, I agree with Michael. I don't think there is a necessary conflict. And in fact, I think there's evidence from the natural world that has theistic implications, that is faith-affirming, even if it doesn't provide an absolute proof for the existence of God. And I see the evidence for intelligent design as some of that evidence that has larger theistic-friendly implications. And so whereas Michael thinks that science and religion occupy more separate realms, I see the realm of overlap to be a little bit greater, and I see that the way in which science and faith overlap is generally has implications that are affirmative of faith. Mm. And I think design and the overwhelming evidence of design provide support for a broadly theistic worldview.
And so even though you differ as to how, science and religion don't have to be at war with each other.
I think we do agree on that, don't we, Michael?
Oh, I think we do, but you know, I think there's an awful lot of difference about how we see these two interacting or not interacting.
I think that's right. Yeah, that's fair.
Michael Ruse is the director of the History and Philosophy of Science program at Florida State University in Tallahassee, and Stephen C. Meyer is the author of Darwin's Doubt and director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. Thank you both for joining us today. From Moses to Mohammed, Joan of Arc to Heinrich Himmler, changemakers of all stripes claim to have heard voices. Moses heard a voice from a burning bush, telling him to free the Jewish people from slavery. The Prime Minister of Canada contacted the spirit of the dead Franklin Roosevelt for guidance about World War II. Some have attributed the voices to God, others to spirits, ghosts, or the dead. Whether you believe this stuff or not, this much is true. Many of the people who shape our world claim to have done so on the advice of spirits. Here to talk about that is Herbie Brennan, author of the new book, Whisperers, The Secret History of the Spirit World. And he joins me from his home in Ireland. Welcome to Interfaith Voices, Herbie.
Thank you very much, Maureen. It's nice to talk to you.
Now, at the start of your book, you have the story of Heinrich Himmler, the Nazi leader who was in charge of the Final Solution for the Jewish people. And I understand he held seances. What happened there?
This was fascinating. This was, in fact, the story that back in the 1970s started me thinking about writing this book long time ago now. I was researching a completely different book altogether about occult practice in Nazi Germany. And I came across this story, which I couldn't authenticate at the time, that suggested that Himmler was holding seances, midnight seances, in the crypt of Quedlinburg Cathedral. And he was calling up the shade of Heinrich the Fowler, medieval German king, and seeking political advice from him. As you say, Himmler was head of the Gestapo. He was head of the SS. He was in charge of the notorious Final Solution. And it just struck me as absolutely bizarre that somebody with that amount of power would be taking advice from what he thought to be a spirit.
And how important were those spirit voices or those seances to his policies about the mass murder of Jews in World War II?
Well, this is the question. I mean, today, of course, there's no way of knowing the precise details of the advice that he was given. But I think we can be quite sure that he was given advice and that he was prepared to take it. It's an absolutely chilling story.
Right, it is. And I guess it says something about good spirits and bad spirits.
Well, certainly, the question of good spirits and bad spirits is an interesting one. But I think beyond that, what interested me, Maureen, was the phenomenon of spirit contact. Without making a prejudgment of what that spirit contact actually is, the phenomenon of spirit contact has, I think, quite clearly influenced human history for millennia. And I think at some stage along the line, you stop short and you say, if this has been happening over the years, and it certainly has, what on earth are we talking to? Are we really, if you go to a modern psychologist, they'll say to you, well, basically spirit voices are products of your own unconscious. They're personifications of something in your deep mind pretending to be external entities. If you go to a spiritualist, they'll say, no, these are the voices of the dead. If you go to a particularly religious person, they may say, this is the voice of God. And the bottom line is, we don't actually know. Nobody has really taken this seriously enough to investigate it properly.
And so is that, that's what you mean by the spirit world? How do you define that?
Well, I made a conscious decision when I started to write the book seriously that I'd use the academic definition. They use the term intermediary beings, and it's a very broad term that takes in everything from God Almighty to the spirits of the dead, to fairies, to mythic creatures. So the book itself has a very broad definition of spirit contact. But I mean, fundamentally, what we're talking about here is what presents itself as the voice or the vision of a supernatural creature.
Would you say that some kind of spirit contact is at the core of the founding stories of many of the world's religions? Like Moses heard the voice of God from a burning bush, and Muhammad talked to God through the angel Gabriel in a cave.
Yes, I would. I think you've given a couple of examples yourself. Christianity, it's not quite so obvious in Christianity, but you still do have spirit communications there. You've got the Annunciation to the Virgin Mary.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the voice when Jesus was baptized. The reason why I didn't actually place much emphasis on Christianity in the book was that the actual doctrines of Christianity were not, so to speak, dictated by a spirit voice. Whereas if you contrast that with Judaism, not only did Moses hear a spirit voice from the burning bush, but eventually went to the top of the mountain and was dictated the basis of Judaism in the Ten Commandments and brought this teaching down from the mountain and passed it on to his followers. So there is a distinct difference there. I mean, in other cultures, if you take Tibet, for example, to this day, the Dalai Lama still takes spirit advice through a state oracle.
Now, you say that this strong tradition of spirit contact was there for most of human history, but it's waxed and waned in popularity. And it became especially taboo during the Enlightenment in the early 18th century, at least in the Western world. Why is that?
It actually became taboo a little bit earlier than that. And basically, it became taboo because the church didn't like competition. If you're listening to spirit voices who you genuinely believe are the voices of angels or the voices of gods, you're not particularly anxious to take the word of your priest or your pope on doctrinal matters.
Now, let's talk for a minute about these professional mediums, the shamans, the oracles, the priests, and so forth, who make spirit contact on behalf of humans. Has their role changed at all? Would you say, for example, that a Catholic priest of today is a kind of professional medium in some sense?
No, I wouldn't. And I wouldn't get very far with that either if I did make that suggestion. I think there have been changes in the situation. I think what happened, first of all, I think the shaman is a slightly different animal to the medium. The shaman, when the shaman wants to find out what the spirits have to say, the shaman goes on a shamanic journey and goes to the spirit world. It's a trance situation and comes back with a particular teaching or message or cure or what have you from the spirit world. The medium, on the other hand, is much closer to the intermediary between direct contact with spirits and the mundane world. And I think there was a development. I think shamanism is certainly the oldest form of spirit contact, the oldest form of religion as far as I can see. But after that, you got the oracular form where the sibyl or the oracle would answer questions, usually by making contact with a god. We're talking about classical times now, obviously. And then you had the spiritualist, the type of medium, who fundamentally functioned to make contact with the spirits of the dead. But out of spiritualism came this idea of making contact with higher intelligences. So you've got a progression there. I think the priesthood arrived on the scene during the classical times, when there was the phenomenon of oracles, the Oracle of Delphi, for example. The Sibyl, who was the actual medium, didn't manage to deliver particularly coherent messages, and consequently there was a priesthood that interpreted the mumblings and mutterings of the Sibyl and passed on the interpretation to the world. And I think that's the foundation of the priesthood that you see today.
Today we're exploring the surprising influence of spirit guides throughout the course of human history. My guest is Herbie Brennan, author of a new book, Whisperers: The Secret History of the Spirit World. We'll be right back.
Interfaith Voices is supported in part by Machar, a Jewish congregation serving secular Jews, humanists, and interfaith families in the D.C. area, offering holiday events and celebrations for life's milestones. More information at machar.org. That's machar.org.
I'm Maureen Fiedler, and this is Interfaith Voices. Religious leaders from Moses to Mohammed reportedly have been guided by voices from another world. And it's not just faith leaders. Politicians and prime ministers, dictators and kings have all claimed to make policy decisions on the advice of spirits, gods, ghosts, and voices of the dead. Let's continue my conversation now with Herbie Brennan, author of a new book, Whisperers: The Secret History of the Spirit World. Almost goes without saying that religious leaders have claimed to have heard voices and seen visions. But what's really unique about your book are your examples of political leaders who say they have made contact with spirits. For example, there's Mackenzie King, who was the Prime Minister of Canada during World War II. And according to his diaries, he sought advice from the spirits of the dead, like Franklin Roosevelt. What's his story?
His story is particularly interesting. He, while he was in office, he was prime minister for, I think, about three terms. While he was in office, while he was an active politician, there was absolutely no hint that he was interested in spiritualist communication. But in point of fact, he developed an interest in it as a young man. And eventually, he went to an American medium, a woman called Vide. she convinced him that she was in contact with his dead mother. And he maintained communication with his dead mother through mediums throughout his entire political career. He also started to pick up on other supposed entities, one of whom was Franklin D. King had had actual contact with him while he was alive, because King was prime minister at that time. But after he died, King then believed he'd picked up contact with Roosevelt in spirit form. And one of the things Roosevelt told him was that he was a much wiser man than Churchill, and that his opinion should be sought by Churchill in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. And at that stage, he came out of the closet and actually told Churchill about this message. And Churchill was not best pleased.
Yes, I can imagine. And then there is Romano Prodi, the Prime Minister of Italy in the late 90s. What was his connection with the spirit world?
That's absolutely fascinating. Prodi is an absolutely marvelous man. He's one of the most distinguished Italian politicians to this day. He was, as you say, he was Prime Minister of Italy. He was President of the European Commission and so on and so forth. He's not, as far as I'm aware, a spiritualist, but back in 1978, he experimented with the Ouija board. And at that time, the leader of the Christian Democrats, a man called Aldo Mori, Aldo Mori had been kidnapped by the Red Brigades and had disappeared, and people were fearing for his life. Prodi, in a sense involving a Ouija board, asked where Mori was being held and got the answer of Gradoli. Now, Gradoli is a small town in northern Italy. He was very intrigued by this information because he couldn't understand how the Ouija board could move, apparently, of its own accord. So he passed it on to the authorities, and the authorities went to Gradoli and found absolutely no sign of Aldo Mori, no sign of the Red Brigade activists or anything like that. And decided that, of course, this had been just a nonsense. In point of fact, Gradoli is also a street in Rome. And when a little bit later the authorities got around to investigating that Gradoli, they discovered that the Red Brigade had been there, which was absolutely fascinating. Mori, unfortunately, was shot then by his captors a week or so later.
So maybe they needed to pick up on what the Ouija board meant a little earlier.
Well, that would be the lesson, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Now, as a whole, of course, this is a totally different way of looking at history. And why do you think this hasn't been studied before? Is it taboo?
I think spirits are very disreputable. I think to academics, the whole area of the esoteric, of the spiritual, it's no longer fashionable. It doesn't have the respectability of a religious belief. It certainly doesn't have the respectability of a scientific belief. And it sort of falls between the cracks. And I think that if you're an academic, a career academic, you would not be best advised to start devoting your time to investigating spirits, because you'd suddenly find that your funding runs out quite quickly and that your upward mobility in academia tends to be shut off, and you become labelled an eccentric who's really got rather silly ideas. I think this is why it hasn't been looked at properly.
And are you aware of any world leaders today who are currently in office who claim to have contact with the spirit world at all?
I'm not aware of any. I would stand over the laws of libel being what they are. There have been some suggestions about at least one American politician you would recognize.
And who is that?
I'm not going to tell you. No, I'm not. Because I really can't establish it as fact. It's very easy. Look, if you're quietly going home tonight and talking to spirits, That's between you and the spirits. And if you keep quiet about it, it's very difficult for me to prove that you're talking to spirits. If, on the other hand, we wait 100 years and I get hold of your private papers, that's when you can definitely discover what's been happening. Historically, it's been happening for hundreds of years. I have no doubt at all, Maureen, that it's happening today, and it's happening at a very, very high level. No doubt whatsoever. Proving it's a different matter.
Herbie Brennan is the author of a new book, Whisperers, The Secret History of the Spirit World. Thanks so much for joining us today, Herbie.
It was my pleasure.
Thanks to all of you good friends for listening to our show again this week. You can always visit us at interfaithradio.org, where you can read more information on our guests, subscribe to our free podcast, and, oh yes, offer your feedback. We love to hear from you. Our senior producer is Laura Quarrell, and our new associate producer is Catherine Roberts. Original music by Mark Stenson. Our engineers this week were Andy Rosenberg, Aileen Humphreys, and Jonathan Cherry. We're produced by Faith Matters, a nonprofit in College Park, Maryland. Do come back next week for more Interfaith Voices. I'm your host, Maureen Fiedler.